Hello, and welcome to Dr. M's Women and Children First podcast. I am your host, Dr. M, and today we sit down with Dr. Kate Kresge. Who is Dr. Kate? Well, she is the head of medical education at Rupa Health, and also the host of the podcast, Root Cause Medicine. Dr. Kate collaborates with clinicians to bring leading-edge root cause medicine information to the world through boot camps, courses, podcasts, articles, and so much more. A democratization of information, let's say. Before joining Rupa, Dr. Kate was the founding director of functional medicine at Sanara Today, a multi-location practice on the East Coast of the United States that combines therapy, coaching, natural medicine, and so much more to help people thrive or be their best selves. Dr. Kate's training in naturopathic medicine began at Bastyr University, where she learned how to approach a patient through a prevention-focused lens. She focuses on therapies like biofeedback, micronutrient cofactor support, general nutrition therapy, exercise, and many other modalities that are low cost but have a high bang for your buck potential to help patients understand their ability to change their disease course. She emphasizes root cause treatments that are both low cost and effective in order to help keep the functional medicine experience accessible to all. Today, she and I sit down to look at ADHD in this third part of the ADHD series and look at the upstream levers that can be pulled on to help reduce the symptom burden. What are the nutritional lifestyle and other mitigating factors for symptom amelioration? How does Dr. Kate approach a child and the family? What is a meal plan? And so much more in order to change the outcome for the person. Let's sit down with Dr. Kate. Well, hello and a good day. It's an absolute pleasure to see you today, Dr. Kate Henry, and so welcome to be on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we met a while ago, and we had a really good connection there, talking about all the great things you're doing with the company you work with, Rupa Health. And I'd like to do a beginning dive there before we get into the world of food plans and ADHD. So talk to me a little bit about what life was like for you as a naturopath, starting out treating patients, and then all of a sudden stumbling into this world of trying to really coordinate the system of understanding the upstream targets through laboratory analysis, really trying to find a better way to do it, and now getting to where you are now.
Absolutely. So, hi guys, I'm Dr. Kate. I started my own practice trying to help people with mental health issues a couple of years ago. And in that process, found out that it was a lot of back end work to help people find and heal the root cause. And what I mean by that is, we'd have great visits where I'd spend 90 minutes with people, but there's a lot of work afterwards, getting them the test kits shipped to them, building them the meal plan. It was hours and hours. On average, it was taking me about 8 hours to put together a comprehensive plan for a new patient with multiple chronic illnesses. And so the problem with that was, in order to keep my doors open, I was faced with this choice, right? Do I charge people more? Do I do less? Right. And Rupa came in with a third option, which is, how do I use technology to be way more efficient? And so Rupa came into my life and saved me 15 hours a week in my practice right off the bat. They did my customer service for me. They helped my clients get really good quality lab tests at really affordable prices and do payment plans. And then they cut my meal planning time down from like 3 hours to 3 minutes. And so I fell in love with them. And I thought, my God, if we're really going to democratize access to functional medicine, we have to use technology to do it. And this company is doing it. And I'm so grateful. And so when the position for head of medical education opened up, I took it. And now my job is to give other doctors a platform to train other doctors in good medicine, and then to really deliver whatever tools these amazing doctors are asking us for.
Yeah. And you have your own podcast called the Root Cause Medical Podcast, right? And
so
the Root Cause Medical Podcast is so aligned with my view of the world that if we don't go upstream, we don't find the real reasons and the levers to pull on and really leverage to change outcome. And the second piece of this, you just sort of said, which is just music to my ears, the democratization of this, right? So in the past, even currently in a lot of places, getting high quality medicine is very expensive, and it is a luxury for those who have means. The primary world of medical delivery right now is still stuck in this archaic sort of reactionary medical system where you're sick, you get a pill and you go home, instead of the preventative, here's what we need to do, here's how we get to the upstream reasons, and here's how to unwind this before your anti-islet cell antibodies turn into type 1 diabetes. And so you really have seen this process before what I would call the democratization through technology. And now you're seeing it through the reality. So let's segue there. What is Rupa Health doing that makes your life so lovely? Because 8 hours to 3 minutes, that's a pretty good ROI if you're asking me.
Absolutely. We'll start with food plan. So a lot of what we're going to talk about today hinges on using food as medicine, right? And something that really irks me, I think that we do a lot in functional medicine is, you know, we might say to people like, well, go home and eat more protein, or go home and get more omega-3s. And it's like, oh my God, really? You're going to charge someone for that? Like, they heard that before. Our job is to teach people how to do this stuff and to do it in a way that's easy for them, that tastes good, that's fun. And the way I found to do it was with a meal plan where you really show people like, okay, you're going to add this much flax and this much chia to your oatmeal in the morning. And that's going to get you 15 more grams of fiber and 3 more grams of omega-3s, which is going to treat your IBS, your high cholesterol, your depression, and your ADHD. Oh, and your anger and anxiety, right? So like, here's the medicine, but here's how you actually make it doable. And that process was taking me a long time to do on my own. Like, I remember my poor husband, I'd be like up till midnight, like so often, because people have a lot of requirements with their meal plans. You know, they'll say, I want to do all this all through food, but I don't want to eat any meat. I won't cook. And I have to have Oreos every day. And so it's a lot of data to manually input and try to mix and match. So when the food plan tool came out, it took that process down and it used the power of AI for me to say, all right, I want to get this kiddo, you know, 1200 calories a day, but I need them to get 3 grams of omega-3s and 90 grams of protein. And I need them to eat these types of foods and this many times a day. And the computer would do what I used to do in hours and minutes. And so it allowed me to then see more people and keep the cost of my care lower. I didn't have to charge for the meal plans, whereas before I did, because it was taking me so long. So that's part of what Rupa Health is doing. The other thing they're doing is they're kind of like the Amazon or the Fullscript of labs. Mm-hmm. And so right now you guys have probably experienced, if you know about things like, you know, a month-long hormone test, like a Dutch test, right? Or like a day-long salivary cortisol. And you've asked your doctor for those. If they're not signed up with a company that actually offers those tests, you really can't go do that at LabCorp Quest. And so in the old days, your doctor used to have to log into a new portal, order a kit, get that kit in the office, give it to you when it comes in, charge you, explain the kit to you. If you mess the kit up, they have to do it again. It's so many hours for the doc. Now, with one click of a button, I can send it to a client and Rupa will handle everything from explaining the kit to the client, you know, walking them through, replacing it if it gets messed up. And so because we're not forcing doctors to do that admin anymore, we free them up again to see more clients. And so while these things might not sound huge, for me, they were life-changing and practice-changing. It allowed me to scale very quickly from one doc to 4 practitioners and from, you know, 200 patients to 800 patients. And so that was so exciting for me because of the impact we were able to make. And right, it was all free.
Yeah. And the beauty of that whole thing is you're impacting the patient. It's not just the benefit mm-hmm. to your life, which is always an important thing, right? But as mm-hmm. healers or practitioners of medicine, we are generally primarily focused on making the outcome for the patient our primary driver of our decision-making. And so this is a win-win on both sides of the fence, which is not common in medicine, at least in the allopathic world. The win for the provider is rare, and the patient sometimes is in the same bucket of rare, but the providers often will sacrifice themselves for their patient. And here's mm-hmm. a scenario where you don't have to do either, which is actually really a beautiful thing. And to the other piece, you're speaking heresy, which I love to hear, the heretical nature of food being medicine, right? As a naturopath, you have been in this world for a long time. As an allopath, now recovering allopath, I am no longer blinded to the reality that this is not true. And it's even beautiful to hear folks like Dr. Chris Palmer at Harvard, who is now a world-renowned, you know, yeah, there, is that his book?
Brain Energy.
Yeah, there it is a world-renowned, you know, psychiatrist who's now espousing the realities of food as medicine. You know, it only took Hippocrates 2,000 years to get his truth in the nutritional world. But to your point, a food plan is massive. Now, you know, the other piece of this is going to be a daunting task for society is how do we get the folks who have high SDN needs, high social determinants of needs, these access points to have the food? Because the beauty of the meal plan, and again, I've played with the Rupa Health meal plan, it's excellent, right? You throw in, I need this many calories for this child, but you can also say, hey, well, by the way, gluten and dairy free, which to me is very, very important in many patients. And oh, by the way, you spit out this 7-day meal plan and it's what a great way to start for somebody. And to your point, it was very quick, like stupid quick. And so
they leave that day with a plan instead of saying like, go follow up with the RD or, oh, I'll get this to you in a few days. It's like, at least they have something to start with. And so you keep the momentum going.
Right. And to the other piece of this, the lab side of it, you know, which is important in some of these patients that have very specific needs, right? I have found we have a very high proportion of folks that are Medicaid enrolled. And so it's difficult to get some of these specialty labs. Years ago, I was able to get some of them. Now I can't. So we found a way to do a lot without, but when you can with, the data is just exceedingly helpful in adjudicating the best path forward for that patient. And so Rupa is doing that piece. And that's another one that why medicine is so far behind technology is a mystery to me, but we are way behind almost everybody in any business space. And so it's beautiful to see now these things coming to light, even if it's not quote unquote everywhere in the system. We're getting big traction in at least the functional integrated medicine space and other docs. So it's awesome the work you guys are doing. And you being at the head of the education side, you're leading the charge of teaching folks how this stuff works, right? So let's segue now into the world of mental health, since that's where your sort of specialization has come to pass over the years. You tend to see the world through a lens of if it's not fixed from the mental health side, it's going to be hard to fix from the physiologic, biological, biochemistry side. So let's take the proverbial, you know, most common problem that we're seeing, the child with ADD, ADHD. What is the 2023, you know, Dr. Kate approach to a child with ADD, ADHD from whatever perspective you want to go, and we'll iterate around?
Yeah. So the first step is always to check for micronutrient deficiencies. And there's actually two ways you could do this. One is checking intake. So are they even consuming enough of these nutrients? And I can talk to you guys about how to do that. The second is checking in their body. Do they have enough in their body? There are nutrients that we know work for managing ADHD symptoms. Things like magnesium and omega-3s are really well studied. B6 and vitamin D are in that category as well. And we can dive into the research on each of those. The second is checking on if they're movement deficient. So we know that things like as little as 5 minutes of jumping jacks before a test can help kids with ADHD score better. Mm-hmm. That's medicine. Yep. Just because it doesn't come in a pill doesn't mean it's not medicine. And so checking on nutrient deficiencies and movement deficiencies is always my kind of first two steps. The third pillar, we know that kids with ADHD have an increased instance of food reactions. So whether it's red food dye or food sensitivities, making sure that we're considering that. And then the fourth is herbal medicine. And then the fifth is a whole person approach. So there's four herbs we can talk about today that every parent of every kid with ADHD should know about. And the whole person approach involves looking at everything. So, you know, we can look at nutrition, we can look at movement, but if your kiddo has a gut issue and they're not absorbing nutrients, we got to fix that first, right? By looking at the whole person. And so that to me is kind of where we're at in terms of advanced medicine for ADHD.
Right.
What do you think?
Let's do it. Let's start with the first part. I think the salient piece of how do you test or know if a patient from a dietary history is going to be deficient in something. I mean, obviously the simple answer is many of them are just because they're eating a standard American diet, but what beyond that are you utilizing as a way to understand whether the cofactor levels are low?
So there's a couple things. Let's talk about the minerals first.
Okay.
So magnesium, zinc, and iron are probably the three that we hear the most about when it comes to ADHD research. There's a couple ways to check those. Let's start with diet. So guys at home, if you're a parent and you have a smartphone or a computer, you can download something like MyFitnessPal or Chronometer and run your kids a sample day of your kids' intake through that and start to see. And the reason I mentioned those two programs is because they actually report out micronutrients. So if you put in their cereal, their pizza, their sandwich, you'll be able to see, did they get enough iron? Did they get enough zinc? Did they get enough magnesium? People are shocked. When they would come in the practice, we use the professional version of Chronometer, and we would do a 3-day analysis, and then we'd flip the computer screen around and show them, this is the nutrition label of your diet that you're eating on average. And they'd be like, oh my God, I'm only getting 30% of the magnesium I need in a day. No wonder I'm anxious. Or like 15% of the iron. No wonder I'm anemic. And then the next question after that is, how do I get more? And so we'll dive into the top food sources of these, but that's a very quick, free, easy, cheap way to do your own audit and see, first of all, are you getting enough? Now, if the answer is yes, and you are getting enough, you still want to check blood levels or tissue levels, because you want to make sure that you're actually absorbing it and keeping it in your body. Right. So in terms of absorption, if you have things like gut issues, that could affect, or you're taking a PPI, a proton pump inhibitor, something for your reflux, that can affect your ability to absorb those minerals. Or maybe you don't have enough stomach acid or enough pancreatic enzymes, or you have SIBO, or you name it. And so to check those in the blood, and we'll go back and forth on this because you may check different things than me, but iron, yeah, I just standard iron panel with ferritin, you know, like just run that. Zinc and magnesium, I love to get RBC magnesium if I can. If I can get RBC zinc, great. That's often a little more expensive. And RBC, guys at home, is our red blood cell. Red blood cells live about 120 days in your blood. And so they're a pretty good snapshot of how much of that mineral has been around for the last 120 days versus serum, which tends to reflect more, you know, how much have you eaten of that mineral recently? And so you tell me though, what do you like to use when you check on those minerals?
So I'm with you on that. I do all red blood cell label testing. I do RBC, zinc, copper, and mag, and then we'll do ferritin. I don't tend to do the whole iron studies panel unless I am concerned that the level of the ferritin just seems seriously dysfunctional. And so if I see it super high, I'm going to do the panel to see if it's related to inflammation or if it's something else going on. And if it's super low, I'm generally just treating them. Now, eventually, I think it is useful to have the rest of it to see what the saturation is. But in the front end, on the first testing, I'm not going full tilt at a lot of those. The vitamin D, I test everybody across the board looking to see if their vitamin D levels up there. And that's going to become super interesting, especially with the data now coming out. I don't know if you saw this recent study in PNAS that just came out. It was in a mouse model. It was translational, but still super fascinating where they looked and noted that the Treg cells that are related to function of the immune system and dampening inflammation, there is some pretty impressive data about there about how inflammasomes are downregulating the effect of the T regulator cells. And we now know that there's a huge issue in kids with inflammasomes being activated by fructose through the uric acid pathway via something we call I'm blanking on the name of it now, but there's a degradation through the deamidinase pathway where uric acid is the terminal byproduct of fructose metabolism. That inflammasome activation, something that are called NLRP3 inflammasomes, which people on my podcast have heard me talk about a lot, is driving this cascade of events that's actually changing the gene regulation of FOXP3, which is then turning down Treg activity, which in the animal models had a net effect of increasing brain inflammation and worsening all mood symptoms. And we know ADHD is comorbid with mood disorders. So I think one of the things that I'm starting to pay attention to a lot more now is D, A, and the good gut bugs, because they're the three main drivers of Treg activity. So I know that's a little bit of a side, but I was really excited to, when I saw that paper, to throw that piece in, because I think we're at that point now with micronutrient or cofactor data, that if we can get these data points, like you're saying, the cofactor numbers, then we could be a little more aggressive about pushing vitamin D orally, because as a fat soluble vitamin, we don't want to give somebody willy-nilly dosing with the potential of making them toxic. Now it's exceedingly difficult to do, but it's possible. Yeah. And then omega-3 index is the other thing I check for, is the final, the things you asked about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we can dive into each of those. So there's some pretty good evidence for omega-3s in ADHD, a study I like. If you guys like to go on PubMed and kind of read this, Was published in 2017, and it's called Do Omega-3-6 Fatty Acids Have a Therapeutic Role in Children and Young People with ADHD? And it was a systematic review of 16 randomized control trials that included over 1,500 kids and young adults with ADHD. And it found that 13 of the 16 studies showed that when people with ADHD took omega-3s, they had improvements in hyperactivity, impulsivity, learning, reading, and short-term memory. What? Like,
huge.
Not only is it like, sure, you can get it in a pill, but you can get this through food. Top sources of omega-3s are salmon, walnuts, chia seeds, flax seeds. And these come with side benefits.
Yeah.
Really, mostly as opposed to side effects. I mean, we know we need omega-3s to make cell membranes and keep our skin healthy, our brains healthy. And so this is amazing. And it's hard. And I think a lot of people, when they hear this stuff, they go like, why haven't I heard about this? You know, it must be that big pharma is suppressing this information and, you know, it's all a conspiracy theory. And the truth is, you can't patent a natural ingredient. And so there's no pharmaceutical rep out being paid to go educate your doctor about omega-3s. They have to learn about it on their own, really, if they're going to learn about it. And that's the reason it's just not making it into more clinics in the first place. And then secondly, if a doc is used to writing on a prescription pad and that's their model of care, it's hard to prescribe omega-3s in that model. They're not covered by insurance. Like, it's a completely different way of doing medicine. And so this is where you and I think are so passionate about food, because if you can just teach someone to, you know, swap their beef for salmon a few times a week, or add some chia, flax, and walnuts to their oatmeal every morning, this is a way to deliver them really powerful medicine that's outside of that prescription pill model.
Yeah. And I'm going to dovetail on that, because I think that's such a beautiful statement. And I think when we start kids on these foods, we should start them at 6 months or even earlier, 4 months to some extent. And sardines should be in the meal plan of a baby. You know, and the biggest problem I think with some of that is that the adults aren't eating these kinds of foods. So if we can get more of these foods into young kids, the omega-3 fats are readily available in food, especially the smaller fish, like you're stating, is where we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck in promoting this healthy outcome. Yeah, perfect. So talk about vitamin D. Where are we getting it from? Is it routinely low in your kids?
Vitamin D is lower in kids with ADHD than kids without. And top food sources of vitamin D are cod liver oil, trout, salmon. And then it kind of falls off a cliff in terms of like how much you're actually getting from these foods. But then it goes mushrooms, milk that's fortified, soy. I think a lot of people think that milk has vitamin D naturally, and they don't understand that milk is actually fortified with vitamin D. And in my experience, I don't like to use milk as sort of like a food as medicine source of nutrients, because it does tend to trigger the immune system of so many kids. And you're nodding. I'm guessing you agree.
Yep.
Yeah. So
not a milk fan.
And people hear this and they go, cod liver oil. Oh my God, my grandmother or my great grandmother used to try to force feed me that. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because we've really only had supplements since like the 60s or 70s. Before supplements, how do you think people got vitamin D in the winter when they weren't able to make it in their skin from the sun? It was from things like cod liver oil and trout. Cod liver oil is an amazing source of nutrients beyond vitamin D. I mean, there's omega-3s and vitamin A, all the things you just talked about. They make it in like smoothie flavors now.
I have such a segue I want to go to quickly when you're done. Oh my God, it's
go,
so exciting.
Go for it. Go now.
So I was just in Iceland, and your point is so well taken. When I was in Iceland, I'm walking around this beautiful volcanic cold Hawaii, and I'm talking to all these folks, and my wife and I had the pleasure of going to a sort of a fish incubator of thinkers, right? So it's everything related to the fish, where all these people would come and sit and think about how we can utilize the fish for a benefit to human society. So they had literally had this entire building dedicated towards all the different pieces of the fish. Somebody was taking the skin, making fish leathers for clothing. Somebody was taking the bones and making calcium. Somebody's taking this. But the big piece of that was their industry around fish oil and cod liver oil in specific, because there's so much cod in those cold waters. And for millennia, all the folks that lived in Iceland would consume cod liver oil because of the vitamin A, vitamin D and the omega-3 fats. Oh, by the way, you're so far north, you're literally on the Arctic Ocean. There's not enough sun there many parts of the year to have adequate sources of vitamin D from the sun naturally. So, oh, by the way, that was their natural remedy towards deprivation through vitamin D deficiency. And so your point's well taken. We've been doing this forever. We just as a society have decided to be a little backwards nowadays, I would think.
Well, I mean, we started to industrialize our food supply in the 70s, and so we moved away from a lot of these medicinal foods, and in particular from the organ meats. So if cod liver oil, the key word there is like it's
Liver.
cod, but also liver. And so when we think about the top food sources of the other nutrients we've already mentioned, like top food source of iron, most people think is beef. It's actually oysters. And we don't really eat a lot of those in America. Top food source of magnesium is pumpkin seeds. Top food source of zinc, oysters, beef, blue crab. So as we sort of moved away from that really traditional way of eating, which look, we kind of needed to. In the 60s and 70s, women entered the workforce. They were not staying at home. We needed to adapt. And we started making TV dinners and packaged foods and really industrializing the way that we created food to feed our society. When we did that, interestingly, because we talk about iodine a lot in like my food as medicine courses, and people don't realize like the, when you go in the store and you see salt and it says like contain does not contain iodine or iodized salt. The reason we started putting iodine and salt in the US decades ago is because we had a major problem with iodine deficiency. People were getting goiter and hypothyroidism. Kids were really suffering. And it's because we don't have enough iodine in our soils in many areas of our country. And so the solution to that on the government's own end was to start putting it in table salt. And we've done that with a lot of foods. So now instead of oysters being like oysters are the top natural source of iron, but in the US, the top source of iron is actually breakfast cereal that's been fortified with iron. Because we know our nation is so deficient. And so we've kind of done this thing where we've created a lot of industrialized foods and now we're fortifying them because we know they're not nutrient replete
Right.
just to keep our population baseline healthy.
But there's a huge flaw in that, right? So that's that we're trying to replete a system in technically a non-natural way. It's not that it's non-natural, but it's not the way you would have ever found this in nature, right? So we're almost saying to ourselves, we don't have to do what's right. We'll do what seems to work. And we've taught ourselves that that's an appropriate way. And again, I come back to this whole inflammasome story again. Another pathway to turning on inflammasomes is excessive carbohydrate intake via a backwards pathway called the polyol pathway. And the work by Rick Johnson is super fascinating here. When they put somebody on a fructose-free diet, they still had uric acid elevations because the folks that were consuming large volumes of starches were just back-ending and making their own fructose, which then ended up turning into uric acid, which then ended up turning on the inflammasome, which then triggers all these cascades. So when we say we're repleting a cereal source with these vitamins and minerals that technically is going to fix the problem, we're actually still kicking ourselves in the foot if that source is a overload of carbohydrate. Now, again, I'm not stating that cereal in and of itself is a net terrible thing. It's the volume in the absence of the foods that you're speaking to, in the absence of the high quality pumpkin seeds or the other foods, the organ meats that are going to give us what historically would have been a cofactor. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And this is where kind of like the whole foods approach comes in. So we kind of we did this thing where we industrialized the food supply and then we started our nutrition education and science caught up and we went like, oh shoot. There's like more vitamins and minerals than we realized. And oh shoot, we're not getting enough. Okay, I guess we'll just like throw them into the things we're already making. But whole foods generally come with a host of other benefits. So when you get a whole food source of a nutrient, it comes with fiber and the right ratios of other minerals. Like for example, copper and zinc are supposed to be balanced in your diet because they're supposed to be balanced in your body. They compete with for each other. They compete with each other for absorption. Whew, that was hard to say. So oysters, for example, are really well balanced with copper and zinc. They have an appropriate physiologic ratio that's good for humans. So when you consume that whole food, you're consuming those nutrients in the right ratio. Right. That doesn't happen when you just like pump zinc into a processed food because you want to help the population consume more of it. And this has kind of been the story in food as medicine for a long time, is us just catching up to the wisdom that was already there when we were consuming whole foods, naturally occurring sources of these nutrients. So yeah, I 100% agree with you.
Yeah. And folks, listen to that loud and clear, what Dr. Kate's saying. I mean, it can't be any more powerfully stated than to understand the reality that synergy of food intake is unbelievably important to maximal output of enzymatic activity, right? So if you have an enzyme, let's just even look at something simple as breaking down fats through this chemical reaction called beta oxidation. You don't just need B1. You actually need B2, you need B3, and you need B9. And oh, by the way, you need magnesium. And then you might need selenium on that little terminal pathway farther down. So if you're consuming a pill that says B12 on it, because the big rage is, oh, by the way, we need cobalamin, but you don't have any of these other cofactors, you just turned one cog in the wheel faster than the others, but in a rate limiting step, you're still in trouble. So the food story is so powerful, as Dr. Kate's saying, because if we get it in a synergistic way the planet has been providing it to us forever, and we've been consuming it for 3 million years, it's not a mistake, right? So I think I so appreciate you diving down that road, because again, as a naturopath, that's your obvious viewpoint. But for most of the planet, and especially allopaths who get 16 hours of nutrition training, that's not intuitive to us. And so I'm just want to really put a huge exclamation point on that statement and not let it just slide by. And so, yeah. So
I was going to say, you'll hear, and you and I hear a lot of functional medicine practitioners, and this is actually our own journey oftentimes.
Yeah.
You know, we go like, hey, here's one way to do medicine, and I'm prescribing pills and doing procedures, and oh, interesting. Now I can just prescribe omega-3s or magnesium in a pill, and it will work better than my other pills. But the farther you get into this, the more you realize it's way more complicated, and actually the easiest way to do it is with food.
Yep.
I truly wish, guys at home, if you're like, God, if I hear one more person tell me to eat cod liver oil or oysters, like, I'm so annoyed. I totally get it. Like, I'm with you. I wish it wasn't this way. Like, if we could get everything through gummies and pills, it'd be great. And look, a lot of times we do. Like, I haven't met a whole lot of 5-year-olds who are willing to, like, you know, dive in and eat oysters unless their parents are really willing to get creative. And sometimes the parents don't have time to cook. This is where there is totally a role for supplements. Like, if we find you're really nutrient deficient and you can't even think enough to think about cooking, great. That's where we'll use the supplements at first. But when we talk about building a sustainable lifestyle, that's where we want to make sure we're doing really good informed consent and telling you guys about your options that are actually the best for helping you stay replete with these long-term in a way that doesn't require you to buy a plastic bottle full of pills every month.
Right. And to your earlier point that you were touching on, if the gut's not healthy, you may not be absorbing these things as well as you need to, and food might not be enough, right? And that's okay, because the process that you would go through with the patient is to get that gut healed so that therefore the absorption would be better. And that's why we track nutrients over time, because eventually you may not need them again. Mm-hmm. But I think that is another good exclamation point note for the listeners. You know, you may need supplements here and there, and that's okay, right? I'm amazed at how many quote unquote regular docs, Huberman, Peter Attia, some of these guys who are really famous now, Rhonda Patrick, you know, I love all of them. And they're talking about ashwagandha. They're talking about L-theanine. They're talking about magnesium in high doses. And it's just, it shouldn't be considered different medicine. It's like, this is, should be what the only form of medicine that's available out there. And it's just, you're hitting all the right points here.
I love that the PhDs are having their moment, because I swear to God, sometimes I read studies and I want to actually like cry, because I'll read like a meta-analysis of biomarkers in suicidality or nutrients in the prevention of cognitive decline. And I look at the list of those authors and the P and guys, just people don't know this. MDs are usually not the ones researching things.
Correct.
We're in clinic, like doc NDs, MDs, we're helping you out. We're giving you your physicals. Like, we're not in the lab. We're not writing research grants. That's not what we do. It's the PhDs who are doing this stuff, the master's level researchers who are doing this stuff, who dedicate their lives to it. And the problem is sometimes the translation of that. And so I'll come across a beautiful study. I just talked to, who did I talk to? Jillian Poles the other day. I literally called her. I found her online because I read this beautiful write-up that she and her colleagues at UNC wrote up about all the nutrients that they know and herbs that they know can help to slow the rate of cognitive decline. It was pages and pages long. And I read it and tears came to my eyes because I thought, these people, these brilliant people, care so much that they probably spent 2 years working on this. And I
Right.
know for a fact they probably didn't get paid very well because there's not a lot of money in researching natural interventions. The only reason you would do that is if you know someone who's suffering from this or you're truly dedicated. And the fact that I, as a clinician, get to read that and then use all the hard work they did to help my patients in the clinic is so critical and huge. So, absolutely, like, if you're a PhD and you're studying human health, you understand biochemistry and you understand that the biochemistry in the human body is run using nutrients. That's full stop. Like, every chemical reaction, think about, we're talking about ADHD. If you want to make dopamine, guys, it's two ingredients: tyrosine and vitamin B6. You put those two together, you have some cofactors like iron, you have dopamine. But how many of you know where to get B6? The number one source of B6 in the US diet is chickpeas, and you have to eat a cup and three quarters per day to get enough
Right.
B6, which most of us are not doing. So, yeah, sorry, I had to get on my soapbox there. I'm so passionate about this stuff.
No, that's the beauty of it. And to your point, it's absolutely amazing how many podcast guests are PhDs, right? And they see the world from a very specific viewpoint, most of the time, a coned viewpoint. Right. So they're seeing their microscopic view of their one particular topic. And some of them will expand out big time too. But that view, parceled with 20 other views, you now have a scatter plot. That scatter plot starts getting filled in, and pretty soon you have a full painting of human health.
And with the internet, we have all of us, so we can all contribute. And I would explain this to my clients all the time because the internet has changed the way we do medicine in a very profound way that I don't think enough of us are talking about. So 150 years ago, your doctor did know everything that there was to know about health because there was probably one book and only one person could read in the town. And that doctor's dad was a doctor and he had trained with that doctor, right? Like, it did make sense that you should trust the doctor and they probably did know more than you about everything health related. Since the internet, that is no longer true. There are 33 million papers on PubMed. No doctor can know it all. We need all of us. We need to get better at collaborating, and we need the people who are expert in certain silos to figure out a way to put this all together. And we're only going to do that by working together. And we're only going to do that by staying humble and making sure that we're connecting our clients to everyone who's doing really cool stuff and more helping them navigate it rather than being like, well, I'm the one with the medical degree. So, how dare you Google this intervention? Like, what? No. Yeah, I was a kid. The reason I got into functional medicine was I was a sick kid. I was sick for 11 years. Couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, stomach aches every day. Got labeled with every mental health condition and IBS you could think of, and turned out I had celiac disease, and nobody diagnosed me till I was 21. I had to diagnose myself pretty much. And overnight, I healed. And I just thought, for probably 3 years before that, I'd been on PubMed. I'm in college, my friends are out partying. I'm on PubMed being like, why do I blow iron and my stomach hurts all the time? And that's how I, found my root cause was reading research papers. And so I'm a huge fan of people looking at the research, especially because in America, your tax dollars probably paid for it.
No, guaranteed. Most of the time, it actually does pay for it. You're right. So let's segue back. So we sort of looked at a couple of the nutrients, the cofactors, as I say, for mental health function. In this case, we're talking about ADHD again. So we've looked at vitamin D. We had the omega-3s. Next one, I think we talked about was magnesium. What about zinc?
Oh my God. Zinc. Really cool study. We researchers gave kids zinc for 8 weeks and then put them on ADHD medication. And it was a randomized placebo-controlled study. So the kids who got zinc were paired up against kids who didn't. They got a placebo. And the kids who got zinc responded to a much lower dose of the ADHD medication, and they had much lower side effects. And so this is a brilliant example of how you can use a mineral or a nutrient and medications together. As
Right.
you guys know, the lower dose you can give someone with of a ADHD medication, the less likely they are to experience the side effects, which can be serious, right? Like insomnia, agitation, loss of appetite. Like, we don't want that to be happening to our kids. And if your kid needs medication, you're really would do them a good service to make sure that you have them respond to the lowest dose of medication possible.
Yeah, and speak.
Go ahead.
Speak to the yoking of zinc and copper and why the toxicant copper potentially, especially in a city environment, could drive your zinc down or what that's all about.
So zinc and copper compete for absorption through the GI tract and in cells. And so if you have a lot of copper in your system because you are drinking from water from copper pipes, or you're consuming a diet that's a lot higher in copper than zinc, which is quite common because food sources of copper, like potatoes, like we tend to consume those more than oysters, which are the top food sources of zinc. And so most of the clients I would see in practice were getting more copper than zinc in their standard American diet. So pair that with your copper pipes. And the fact that you're probably not consuming enough zinc, and people wind up with that imbalance. And so sometimes all you have to do to fix it is just give someone a little bit more zinc. And that's actually, rather than like go through all these like gnarly chelation protocols, what's actually recommended as being safest is to just optimize the intake of zinc. And so this is partly why people feel so much better when they take zinc, because most of us aren't consuming enough. So you hear the person who says, like, oh, I started taking zinc for my immune system and I feel great, you know. So many people did that during COVID. So we always want to pay attention to both nutrients. And when you're supplementing with one of them, you want to track both. You can overdo zinc. So you shouldn't take zinc on an empty stomach. You should talk to a professional about the dose that's right for you. Probably shouldn't be taking 50 milligrams unless you're a very large adult. And you should be tracking to make sure your copper doesn't get too low and your zinc doesn't get too high. Often, when we would prescribe a multivitamin for folks, we'd prescribe one that had both copper and zinc. So, like 12, 15 milligrams of zinc for adults paired with 1 milligram of copper was kind of like the ratio that you tend to want, 10 to 1.
Yeah, and I think to your podcast name, The Root Cause. When I think about in kids, when we first started in pediatrics, if you were zinc deficient because of a disease called acrodermatitis enteropathica, you had chronic diarrhea, you had chronic skin issues, you had chronic immune system dysfunction, and oh, by the way, that's the exact same thing that happens on a much smaller scale if you're zinc deficient. So it's all the fast cell turnovers, and all those fast cells happen to be, brain, immune system, skin, gut. So I think your point's very well taken that when we put it back in, you just help these enzymatic effects go. And oh, by the way, you look pretty normal again. But I spent some time listening to Peter Thiel a good bit, and some of these researchers I think is super fascinating when they find the disease that is caused by a genetic mutation that makes whatever it is knockout. And we see the worst case scenario of something being wrong. That's our extrapolation point back to everybody on the continuum of where they are in health. So I think as you go through these cofactors, that's sort of a very sensitive way of looking at it is you may not be the terminal breakdown point, but somewhere along that continuum, you may not be functioning as high as you need to. And this is where, to your point again, what Rupa Health is doing is allowing us to have these lab tests because you don't have to be at that point a scatter plot of possibility. You're more a N of one, which is true functional personalized medicine.
And you guys can get these tests and kind of see this is where the individualized medicine comes in. like how much omega-3s do you need? How much zinc do you need? How much magnesium? How much iron, right? You wouldn't want to just start taking all this stuff because everyone's different.
Yeah.
So it's amazing to have that insight into your own health and not have to guess when you can test.
Beautifully said. All right. What else? What else would you test or what else would you start looking at from an ADHD perspective? I think the cofactors are so critical and I couldn't agree with you more.
I like to talk about herbs if you're up for it, just
Let's go.
because there's a study on saffron and methylphenidate. It just came out a couple of, like, I think, let me see when it came out. I have it written down.
News to me, something fresh off the presses.
I
Let's
know.
Do it.
It's so fun. So it got published in 2019. The study's called Crocus sativus versus methylphenidate in treatment of children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, a randomized double-blind pilot study. They used 20 to 30 milligrams of saffron a day. So saffron's like a spice, you know, that we tend to put on our food, but you can get it in a pill. And they did 20 to 30 milligrams a day compared to methylphenidate. They studied these kiddos for 6 weeks. And at the end of 6 weeks, both groups were the same, which means the kids who only took saffron had as much of a drop in their symptoms as the kids who were prescribed methylphenidate, which is a pretty heavy duty ADHD medication.
Mm-hmm.
And it was statistically significant, right? So their score went from like 25 symptom score to, you know, around 15, which is a very big drop in symptoms.
Do we know this what the mechanism is?
You know what's funny? They didn't go into that too much, but I think you and I would both guess it's probably the same. I would guess it's the antioxidant capacity.
Mm-hmm.
We know that people tend to use saffron a little bit like they'd use a serotonergic compound in clinical practice. But in the same way that we know that things like pycnogenol or even blueberries can help kids with ADHD because of the amount of antioxidants they provide and flavonoids they provide. My suspicion is it's something to do with that. But in the meantime, saffron is really like a can't hurt, might help, or will help in this case, therapy that you can actually add alongside your meds. You just might, what I tell my parents is like, watch your kids' dose. They might become a little over-medicated because now it's like they're taking two, you know, twice the amount of meds. But that's a beautiful intervention that parents need to know about and that you can try before your kid tries meds and just watch for 6 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Some other ones are pycnogenol, bacopa, ginseng, ginkgo. Tell me what you think of pycnogenol. It's pretty benign in my experience. Like there's not a ton of side effects that come with it.
No side effects. I'm just not convinced it's that efficacious. I learned under Sandy Newmark years ago in Arizona. Love Sandy. Excellent ADHD MD. And we spent a lot of time talking and that was the one that may or may not have been. And I've just never seen clinically that it makes a huge lever pull that allows me to change the medicinal outcome of what actual hard drugs I'm using. So fine, as with most herbs, the risk is very, very low. But in this case, I'm not convinced the upside is too high.
Yeah. It's like $15 a month. And so pycnogenol is pine bark extract.
Yep.
And the study that I found compelling, they looked at 1 month of supplementation, 1 milligram per kilogram per day at body weight. So like a pretty significant dose. But they saw that it improved hyperactive behavior, attention, visual motor coordination, and concentration. And so I agree with you. It's very gentle, similar to saffron. Like I don't have folks come back and be like, my God, the first day I took saffron, I was a whole new person. It's more like because these are antioxidant therapies, they take a while to work. And so, you know, it's more like you put these in your routine, kind of set it and forget it, right? Like this is your thing. You just, along with saffron, you're going to take it once or twice a day. And in 6 weeks is when you're going to check back in. And so the way you guys should do this is if you're going to start this, bring your kid in or yourself into the doctor, assess your symptoms where they are right now. Make sure it's safe for you to take this stuff and then set an appointment for 6 weeks to come back, retake that ADHD assessment. Because often what happens is people are better and they don't realize it, which is kind of cool. You know, like we normalize things, we go on with our life. But I mean, how many times have you experienced like someone comes back in the office and they're like, I'm not any different. And you're like, well, you're still having headaches. And they're like, no. You're like, well, what about your diarrhea? Oh, that's gone. You know, you're like, okay, I think you're a little better.
Yeah, totally. So true.
Yeah. So these are kind of like the gentle, relatively safe things that I like to encourage folks to explore, because it, I mean, putting, treating someone with ADHD is a really charged topic, particularly between parents, particularly if their parents are in different households. And so starting with supplements can feel safe for everybody and can really help, along with things like exercise, you know, and like treating the whole person and dietary changes and all that. But herbs are the original medicine. So most people don't know, like, we make aspirin from willow tree bark. Like, a lot of our original medicines came from plants. So plants work. They're powerful. Yeah. We just, you can't patent them again. And so we don't have anybody out there really talking about them because they're not being paid to talk about them. Other ones that are really cool are the nootropics, like Bacopa. Mm-hmm. I tend to see people respond to nootropics faster than the more antioxidant flavonoid rich herbs. I don't know about you, but it seems like, you know, you take your Bacopa in the morning and people kind of feel it. They feel like within a few hours, they notice their concentration is improved.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting in my world, again, being such a high penetrance of kids who don't have means to afford, mm-hmm. the levers are not as lovely to pull on as the different herbals. You know, it'd be nice mm-hmm. to do more of those. In some of my patients, it's something we can do often. But, and so I found that the vast majority of the outcomes are net benefit through dietary, exercise, mm-hmm. and basic basic micronutrient cofactor changes. And those tests are, I can do through a LabCorp or Quest, you know, for the Medicaid population, for, you know, that actually works out for the paying population. Again, I think getting deeper into the world of the labs that you're able to order through Rupa Health, I think is the way to go. Cause again, you get deeper and closer to the different phenotypes, the different ways to pull on levers that are more efficacious over time. And again, to your earlier point, which I think is so important, the more of these levers you pull on that are non-medicinal, the dose of drug, if at all, and I want to say that pretty clearly, if at all, is low. Like, I have 15, 16 year olds on 10 milligrams of Adderall, which is literally like nothing, and doing phenomenally, where they needed 40 milligrams when they were on no meds, no diet, no nothing. And so that's a big one. So let's segue in a little bit more towards diet, right? So you have the personalized meal plans, but before you even get to a personalized meal plan, you had the Dr. Kate pre-personalized meal plan AI. Now you had the new version. That's the 3 minutes. What were you generally recommending in a global 30,000 foot view dietarily mm-hmm. for folks?
So let's start with what the evidence says. So great study, adherence to a Mediterranean diet and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in children, case control study. What they found was that kids who ate more vegetables, legumes, fruits, nuts, grains, and fish had a decreased odds of developing ADHD. We also know that people with ADHD tend to consume a more processed food diet, and they tend to experience more food sensitivities than kids who don't have ADHD. So knowing all of that, we would start with nutrition by addition. And so what I have found is that kids with ADHD tend to graze. They like to snack. If you just put things in front of them, they will eat them. And so we'd start with, like, you know, put blueberries in front of them, put more, you know, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds. The way that you do that is you keep trail mix that's just fruits and nuts and seeds in the car. Don't have it be full of M&Ms and pretzels just yet. Like, start getting them more fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds that way. Do veggie chips, right? On the way to soccer, carrots and hummus. When they come back from school, right? Have vegetables out with a dip. It's okay to have a little bit of a dip that they like, whatever they can use to get it in their body. Start by adding those and just try for 5 a day. And that alone would often help kids. The other thing is protein. If you don't have enough tyrosine, you cannot make dopamine. So many of our ADHD kids and adults don't eat breakfast because they wake up late, they rush out the door, they grab something easy, and then they're on a blood sugar roller coaster all day, and they don't have enough tyrosine to really get their dopamine going for the day. And so we would start with adding things like protein shakes. Like, start small. You know, if you can't do a full course breakfast or like oatmeal or eggs or whatever in the morning, have pre-made protein shakes your kid takes with them on the door, you know, way out the door. And they can be gluten-free and vegan. But getting that nutrition by addition, just add, is always the first step for us. And again, showing people how to do it. So writing it down for them, not just saying, go get more protein shakes, but saying, you're going to buy this brand from this store. And every day they're going to take it on the bus at this time, keep it by the front door. Helping them think through that was really critical, because with ADHD, your frontal lobe function is just not as consistent in terms of forward thinking and planning. And so that's what would tend to trip up these clients, is they'd go all excited and they'd be like, okay, great, I'm going to eat more protein. And then you'd lose them through the planning part. So like, you have to help them with that. That's good medicine for them. So that's where we would start. With the AI food planner, you just type all that in and it does it for you in 3 minutes. And you could say, like, really likes Chipotle, wants smoothies, or hates this, and it will eliminate those options. And yeah, it's fun.
And while I know we're gonna get to the end, but why don't we just say it now for people? What's the website so people can go on and get to the AI food planner? Because this is just, I think to me, this is where everyone's gonna jump on right away.
Yeah. So it's rupahealth.com, R-U-P-A health.com. So right now the food planner is only available for practitioners, and that's a broad, it's not just doctors, right? It's like nutritionists, health coaches, RDs, personal trainers, like anybody who's doing work with clients with food can sign up to use it. It's free. Our magazine has really excellent articles. I forgot to say that. So most of you guys know, if you type into WebMD, treat ADHD, what you're going to get is like information on medicines and maybe exercise and maybe therapy. Our articles give you all of the research. You've heard me mention a couple studies. We summarize all that for you and say, here are the nutrient interventions you should consider. And as far as I know, no one else is really investing in doing that like we are. We have full-time writers, physicians on staff who are writing up these algorithms for you guys. So you can type in natural treatments for ADHD, the Rupa article, type it on the Rupa magazine, it'll come up, and then it'll tell you, what should you test? What should you focus on? Take that to your clinician, and it gets you one step ahead.
So if they go to rupahealth.com and there's a drop-down tab for magazine?
Yeah.
Okay. And so drop down tab for magazine, everybody, and then you can put in there information you're looking for, specifically ADHD. And I highly encourage everyone to get on there, because this is, again, the more information you have in your armamentarium, the more ability you have to make change, and the make change is how you get healthier, because to be stagnant, we know that's not the answer to anything. And so I love that. I love that, Kate. I think, you know, for me, I think of the charge being led by all is democratization of healthcare. Two things need to happen. One, information needs to be available, which you're doing that lift, and that's phenomenal. And then the second piece is, some way, shape, or form, we have got to convince the powers that be that food should be an inalienable right of quality. And the federal government subsidizing corn, soy, wheat, and rapeseed oil is not the answer to quality. And that's how we're living in this dysfunctional world, again, where this immunology deep dive I've done for the past 4 years has come to smack me right in the face that everything we're doing is actually making us immunologically insolvent, which is then just leading to the disease based on our epigenetic and genetic predispositions, which is just a mess. It's crazy. It is a mess. All right. So we've done cofactors. We've touched on the big players. We've talked about some of the herbs, which I think everyone should talk to their provider about, but I agree with you. Some of them I think could have some pretty good, additional benefits to maybe lower dose, if not help get somebody off the medicine if possible. Diet is massively important. I think other than stress reduction, it's probably the most important piece of the pie. What about exercise?
If your kid has ADHD, they are an athlete. Let's just start there. They are a natural athlete. They need to move. They will need to move every day for the rest of their lives for the sake of humanity and themselves. So get them in a sport. I say this lovingly. Guys, I love people with ADHD. Like, I myself have ADHD. I am not judging you. Like, I'm right here with you. Like, I have to work out if I'm going to be focused for the day. Like, and it's just, honestly, your kid with ADHD is going to be set up to be healthier than their peers if you get this right, because they actually have to work out and they have to eat healthily in order to manage their ADHD symptoms. It's kind of like the canary in the coal mine. Like, their attention goes, their behavior starts to deteriorate, you know they're not healthy. Somebody else without those symptoms is going to go 20, 30 years and wind up with type 2 diabetes or a chronic condition that is going to be a lot harder to reverse because they didn't catch it early. So yes, it's a lot more work and it can sometimes be a heavy lift for parents of kids with ADHD, but congrats, you've got an athlete, put them in sports, and something as simple as 5 minutes a day. So like I said, there's that study, I'll find the name of it for you, but that found that, again, 5 minutes of jumping, 5 minutes of running around, that's all it takes. It doesn't have to be an hour. You don't have to enroll them in like an expensive sports program. It's called The Impact of Exercise Interventions Concerning Executive Functions of Children and Adolescents with ADHD, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. Great paper to read if you're wondering, what does the science actually say about the type of exercise that truly works for people with ADHD? And so when we look at this and we see, wow, exercise works. Again, think, well, that's medicine. If it works to control symptoms, it's medicine. So how do I make it a prescription that my kid takes every day? What are some of the things you tell your clients to do?
Well, you know, I think anything that stimulates muscle activity, so that mm-hmm. can be cold plunges, that can be running, that can be isometric muscle contraction. I mean, literally, I tell kids all the time, whatever works for you. I'm a drummer. You know, I'm like you, I have ADHD, and my parents should have known very early on that the only option for safety in their minds was to put me on something that could allow me to burn through calories rapidly. Why they let me pick drums? Fascinating question. You know, loud, stupid. Yeah, whatever. I love them to death for letting me do that to them. But yeah.
Yeah.
So anything that allows the child to burn muscle energy in the best way that keeps them happy, right? Because again, I think part of this, and one of my senior partners is 85, has said all in all over and over again, self-esteem is massive. And if you don't have self-esteem and you have ADHD, you're set up for self-medication failure, which will be alcohol, drug, something. And so in order to prevent that segue from occurring inside a child's mind, it's allow them to know that work and their desire is the pathway to self-reliance and self-esteem. And so if a child says to me, hey, I love tapping my pencil, amen, tap your pencil, right? But you have to do it in a way you're not disturbing the world around you. So what does that mean? Tap in a place that's not going to be dysfunctional, tap on your leg, you know? So it really comes down to sort of looking at the child and asking them what they like to do that's movement-oriented. If they say they want to sit and play video games, well, let's talk another idea that might help you move muscles, right? And ideally, it's better the bigger the muscle that's moved, the more caloric burn that occurs, that I think is actually what's charging the brain to be functional in this period of time. And so my son used to get up before physics tests and jump in cold plunge and do a 3-minute cold plunge. And that was incredibly functional for him to get his brain tracked and locked. So I don't sort of give a prescription for this, like you have to go run, but I definitely give a prescription for you need to do something, and it should engage some form of large muscle activity, preferably. Like, I mean, even so much as like I can be sitting at this desk right now just twitching my feet constantly, I think is completely functional towards burning the caloric energy that's needed for function. And again, this gets into that whole piece that you were talking about earlier with antioxidants. Every time you burn ATP in a mitochondria, the antioxidants are doing the job of protecting us from the damage that is released by the burn. And so I think that's a big, big part of this, is making sure that we have access to all of these wonderful food sources while we're doing the exercise and the energy. And to me, that's the big part. I think I got you back.
I'm back.
Oh, awesome. I thought I lost you for a second there. Yeah. So Kate, that to me, I think is a big piece of the ADHD story. I think one of the greatest failings, I think, in modern healthcare is that we're not helping our educators find other ways to look at our children. I often see a child diagnosed with ADHD by the same teacher over and over again, and the next year and the year prior, they had no issues. And so some of that, I think, is the big piece of talking to the family about what is the failure point? Are they truly failing? Or is it just that the teacher doesn't like that they're fidgety? And if that's the case, that's a conversation about the teacher, not so much the child. And my favorite book right now is The Gardener and the Carpenter by Alison Gopnik. And I highly recommend, it's a 2016 book. She's a Stanford PhD sociology professor. And she basically wrote this book that's an anthropologic view of parenting. And what she said was, what do we really need in order for a plant to grow? right? You need sunlight, you need soil, you need water, and you need safety. Well, that's a great euphemism for humans. What does a child need to grow? They need safety. They need nourishment. They need whatever the energetic outputs are. They need an environment that is allowing them to be the best version of themselves. Whether they grow straight up to the left a little before they go up to the right a little bit, that's irrelevant. And frankly, the carpenter side of us is too much of the directing of the child's growth. Like, we want this child to be Harvard, straight A's. Yeah, not so much. And her book is so poignant to the time now that we need to be more gardeners in our approach to kids. And I think I actually look at that as my approach as a clinician, that I want to be more of a gardener than a carpenter for my kids. I want them to know that their world in my world is, I love them so much that I'm going to provide safety. I'm going to give as much nourishment as I can to them, but which direction they grow, that's entirely up to them. And I support their decision. So if they want to be a drummer like me and make a lot of noise, I got you. How I can get you there, I don't know.
I love that. Wow, that's beautiful. That's awesome. I think one of the most powerful studies I read recently said that in terms of like the neurobiology, things that we know are different in the brains of kids with ADHD versus their counterparts who don't have it, is that they tend to be about 3 years behind developmentally.
Yeah.
When we look at their brains. And I think that's another helpful thing to remind parents. Like, the brain doesn't finish developing until we're 28. Mm-hmm. And so your 18-year-old with ADHD is going to look more like a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
And it will even out, but just reframing your expectation there can be really, really helpful for parents who have so many pressures on them, right? Like, they want their kids to be successful and go to college, and like, they're comparing them against their peers. And it's tough as a parent. But yeah, something I said there, I saw your, what did you want to add there?
I absolutely love what you just said. We should have a new diagnosis: constitutional brain delay. We have constitutional growth delay, where the bone age, we know the kid's going to be at age 16, finally hit their growth spurt. And by 19, they're fully achieved height. But up until then, they were short stature. Oh, no, not short stature, constitutional growth delay. I am going to call up whoever makes these ICD-10 codes. I'm the Dr. Kate.
Love him.
Constitutional brain delay. That's exactly right. I love it. I love it.
Yeah. And just like that patience, right? And letting them, not putting the intense pressure on them, because we know if kids with ADHD have a very, a parent who gives them a lot of negative feedback, who's very critical of them, they actually do worse. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because the way the frontal lobe interacts with the part of your brain that controls fight or flight and your emotions, when kids have ADHD, they don't have as much of an ability to inhibit that emotional center of their brain. And so when you're very critical of them or harsh with them, they feel that more, and it actually makes it harder for them to concentrate because they literally have less blood flow in their frontal lobe. Mm-hmm. So if you can get to a place where you have a little more zen and more patience and give that kid with ADHD a longer leash and trust that, I mean, ADHD comes with a lot of cool skills, right? Tend to be highly creative, think outside the box, can work really hard on things that they're intensely interested in. I think as clinicians, we don't really, as long as we're helping that kid to the best of our ability, we don't worry about them. We know it's going to take them a few more years maybe to get to where they need to be, but allowing them that time is medicine for them.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm not too sure there's much to add on top of that. That's just the perfectly stated way. I mean, it is time, right? Four-letter word is ultimately the answer for a lot of these kids. I know for me, I think you said 3 years delayed. Let's go 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
It took a long time. Yeah, it turned out okay. It had a lot of bumps and bruises, a lot of falling off this. But yeah, no, it turns out okay. But patience is the key and time is the key. So yeah, I echo that 100%. Hmm. Solid. What else? Any other last thoughts? I know we've covered a gamut of really interesting parts of the ADHD story, the great Rupa Health story, your story, which again, I applaud you, what you're doing to the democratization of healthcare, every person that touches that, and you're doing a big lift with your work with Rupa. So kudos to you. Any other thoughts that we didn't touch on in the ADHD realm that you wanted to get out to the airwaves?
I think just for parents, I just want to talk to parents for a second. Reflecting to your kiddo, which of their needs have been met and which haven't when they're struggling can be really powerful in so many ways for them. So saying something like, if you notice your kid is having more symptoms that day, so things like hyperactivity, they're kind of bouncing off the walls, impulsivity, they're interrupting, they're blurting out, they're not paying attention, they're being disruptive, seeing that as a symptom and going, hey, don't you think it's interesting? You didn't get very much sleep last night. Do you notice it's a little harder for you to pay attention today? That does so much for your kid. First of all, it helps them see those behaviors as symptoms. It helps them make the connection between not getting enough sleep, not getting enough movement, not getting enough protein, not getting enough veggies to their symptoms. And it disconnects the shame that we often see as a result of kids not understanding that these are symptoms rather than character flaws. Because the whole rest of the world is going to tell them it's about character. If you love this kid, you have to start to help them see that it's a symptom and that it's caused by something physiological. And that will buffer them and help them be more resilient to the challenges that they're just naturally going to encounter as somebody who doesn't have a neurotypical brain entering into a world that is built for neurotypical people. And so the more you can reflect to them, the more you can help them see, and it's not going to work the first time, and it's definitely not going to work with little kids the first time, but if you can stay consistent, and when you mess up, what you can say is, you know what, I got frustrated with you earlier, and then I realized you haven't eaten lunch. I think you're hypoglycemic. Let's have you eat some lunch and let's try this again. And teaching your kid the time for them to do focused, boring work, which is the hardest thing for someone with ADHD to do, is not when they are undermoved and underfueled. And teaching them to say, I want you to go run around the block, we're going to have a snack, and then you're going to do this, will do so much for them and for you. And just good job. If you're listening to this, I already know you're doing a good job with your kid or with yourself. So just hear it from us. Like, we see you, we appreciate you, you're doing great.
Yep. You nailed two other pieces that we hadn't gotten to. I didn't think there were many others, but you hit them. Sleep, massive. So important. Anyone who has a toddler who didn't get a good night's sleep knows what the emotional regulation is the next day. We are not much different, all of us, it humans. So that's a big, big piece. And then I love, Kate, that you hit, it is a behavior. It is not the person that is the problem, especially some of these children who are growing up in really challenging environments, right? It is the behavior that we should focus on. You're just like Carol Dweck's work around work ethic, right? We don't want to praise someone's beauty. We don't want to praise somebody's brilliance, because then we set them up for failure when they're older and they're not as beautiful anymore, or they're not as brilliant. But if we praise the work, if we praise the positive behavior, if we praise the things that they are leading themselves with in their best struggle to be their best self, they will have more bandwidth to keep fighting. Because when you beat someone down, unless they have amazing, I don't even know what the right word is there. They have something within them that says, I'm going to fight back no matter what. That's the Arnold Schwarzenegger story. That's the Elon Musk story. If you read Walter Isaacson's new book, I mean, these people had just something within them to able to overcome no matter what abuse and trauma was hurled at them. It doesn't mean they're healthy emotionally, just like anyone who's been abused over and over again. But the fundamental piece there is, you hit it on the head. If we tell somebody, that's your behavior that I'm frustrated with, not you, I love you, right? And I say this to kids in the office, and I know you do too. When I see a kid in my office, I'd like, listen, I don't know what you're going through, but I love you so much, I'm going to sit here and we're going to talk about it. And you know what? Those parents that you're fighting with right now, they love you, because they wouldn't be here if they didn't. Because I can tell you, I have a lot of parents who don't love their kids and they don't come, they don't do anything. So yeah. It's a mic drop moment for you there, Dr. Kate. You hit two big pieces. I'm not too sure I have anything left. So unless you have something else to go, I think we like the ADHD story, according to Dr. Kate Henry.
I had the best time. Thanks for having me on. Let's do this more.
I love it too. So for everybody to go out there and find your work, where can they find you? I know they're going to Rupa Health already. We know we have your fabulous podcast that we already talked about, the Root Cause Medicine podcast. And yeah, Root Cause is the only way we should be looking at anything. Where else can they find you? Are you a LinkedIn? Are you a social media person?
Yeah. We have Rupa Health as Instagram. and a Facebook. It's actually kind of fun. We're running some competitions right now. You can go try to see if you can guess the root cause of a lot of our case studies that we've got, which is really fun. So just find us on any social media platform. I have my own website. I don't keep it up to date, but it does kind of walk people through where they can find free information about mental health and natural treatments for it. And it's just my name, drkatehenry.com. I just got married, so my name changed to Kresge. But yeah, guys, I'm just so grateful that we have these platforms to share this information with you, but there's so much more you can learn. So allow this to be like a jumping off point. And I'm thrilled to have you come on our podcast to teach us more about pediatrics. But just know we're behind you. Yeah. Great job, guys. Everybody who's listening.
They heard it here, folks. Dr. Kate Henry, absolute pleasure having you on the show. Look forward to seeing you next week and other times down the road and all the wonderful work you're putting out to the world. I'm grateful for you and I'm grateful for this hour. Have a great day,
Likewise.
Kate.
Likewise. Thanks, you too.
There are certain people you talk to in life who just really are easy conversationalists, and Dr. Kate's one of those. We covered a lot of ground, and I think that when you think about it from the perspective of the triplicate of Dr. Greenblatt, Dr. Newmark, and now Dr. Henry Kresge, you see three different ways of looking at an approach to attention deficit disorders in children. And as with anything in medicine, there are many ways to skin the cat, to find the road to help the child. Not all children are the same. Frankly, almost none of them are. And so approaching each child as an N of one, to me, always makes the most sense. So looking for upstream mitigating factors that can be pulled on lever-wise to change outcome is the key. And I think when we sit down with these experts, we start to see pathways that open up before us that we can start paying attention to. And in Dr. Kresge's case, working for Rupa Health, she's got an amazing resource bank at her disposal to allow providers to learn a ton quickly on their journey to figuring this stuff out and allow patients to have access to all kinds of new medical education. I highly encourage everyone to look at the meal planning part of the program for the providers on this podcast, because this is something that's super cool. And the aggregation of taking data that is in their computer system and throw in inputs like, I'd love to see a diet that's gluten and dairy free with about 1800 calories a day, you know, with mostly plant-based, and boom, spits out a 7-day meal plan. That would take hours and hours, as she stated. And now you don't have to. Now you can get it pretty quickly and hand it to your patient, walk out the door. It's pretty cool. So fundamentally, these are some simple things. And then having access to learning about labs for the providers that are trying to get a better knowledge of how to do sort of this modern version of upstream medicine, instead of always looking at ADHD or these other disorders as a deficiency of a Ritalin or a stimulant. Let's look upstream as to what really is driving the need for the medicine in the first place. And can we abrogate the need for having medicine? The answer is yes. I do it all the time in clinic. So I think fundamentally, this is the way we want to look. And having an access point like Rupa Health is a great start to any practitioner's journey down this road. And frankly, any parent who wants to help their child. And so highly encourage you to check out their website. Lots of videos on there. I'm actually making some videos for them now too. And I hopped on Dr. Kate's podcast a few weeks after we did this one. And so you're welcome to listen to that as well. We talked about asthma and some other things. So sort of cool. Again, the democratization of information, it's free. And that just changes so much. You no longer have to pay tons of money to get good information. And that is the way it should be. So with that, I'll leave you. As always, hug those kids. Remember that this information for this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. It is not a substitute for advice and or treatment provided by your physician or other healthcare professional and is not to be used to diagnose or treat a health issue. And it does not constitute the development of a provider-patient relationship. Have a great day.